All right, so we're still in the prologue, so this is a little bit misleading. We will finish it today, but I wanted to remind you of a couple of things I said about the prologue. The prologue, the use of the term logos, which is translated word, refers to the fact that John is basically saying that Jesus fulfills the role of the logos, of Greek philosophy, but also Judaism, of contemporary Judaism. So what that means is, from the philosophical point of view, if you remember, there's a problem because you have this concept of God as transcendent. He's above everything. He's so much greater than everything. But then the problem is, how does he relate? How does he communicate with beings imperfect like us, right? How can you have transcendence, but also the term is immanence? How can that work together? Well, one answer to this in Greco-Roman philosophy is the logos. And John picks up that very term for that reason. Okay, so that's one reason he uses it. The other reason that I mentioned was in Judaism, the term logos is associated with wisdom, but also Torah. And that's exactly why I think John mentions the law here, specifically Moses. We'll get to that in just a minute. All right, so that was a very truncated summary of the prologue. But let's try to finish it up then. And I say that like I'm going to rush through. I'm not rushing through this, okay? And that's something else I have to say. We're still taking our time, but ultimately, I don't want to rush through it. Is it? Appreciate it. Okay, so, like I said, we're not, at some point I will have to pick up the pace. I'm aware of that, but not right now. Okay, not going to do that today. Okay, so, remember the second part of the prologue deals with, or dealt with, the witness of John the Baptist. And that's another question. Why in the middle of this prologue, this lofty discourse about Jesus, why does he then interrupt it in a way with this message about John the Baptist? And I think what we see about John the Baptist later on in this chapter answers the question. John the Baptist is not to be identified with the Logos. He is merely somebody giving testimony about the Logos. All right? So, the he here, of course, is Jesus. He came into the world. He created the world, but they didn't know him. And then verse 11, he came to his own people, and his own people did not accept him. And again, this isn't. We shouldn't take this literally, right? Because this would mean there wasn't a single person who believed in Jesus. Obviously, that's not true. But the majority did not accept him. And those that did, though, he says, they become children of God simply because of God himself. And then this is verse 14. This is, you remember last time I said, okay, he's putting this discussion about Jesus as Logos within these categories of Greek and Roman philosophy and also Judaism. But this is where he blows up the categories. This is where the categories don't work anymore. Because he says, the Logos became flesh. If I were a Stoic and I was reading this, I would think, what on earth are you talking about? I mean, that's just not even conceptually possible, right? And then, on the other hand, if I'm familiar with the Jewish tradition and I see this, I'll say, well, how can the Torah become flesh? That doesn't make any sense. How does wisdom become? It doesn't work. But John says the categories have to change. which I think is a very powerful principle we see in the synoptics with reference to the Messiah. Right? Think about that. The Messiah, in Second Temple Jewish texts, was supposed to do one of two things or both. I guess I should say either. And that is, he was supposed to overthrow the Romans, which is the one we typically hear about. There are also other texts that say the Messiah is supposed to usher in a new utopian-like state. Well, did Jesus do either of those things? He didn't. By the way, I think it's kind of funny. I asked that question in a lot of different classes, and people are hesitant to say Jesus didn't do either one of those things. But he clearly did, right? He didn't. And yet, the Gospels are unanimous. The New Testament is unanimous. And Jesus is the Messiah anyway. So again, even though he didn't explicitly fulfill either one of those expectations, they still thought about him as the Messiah. There was some compelling evidence which forced the disciples to say, you know what? Even though he didn't do either of these things, he's still the Messiah. I think that's pretty powerful. Same thing here. He's still the Logos, but he also became, took upon flesh. The Logos became flesh. Now, this notion is also referred to as the incarnation, right? You've heard of that before. Where do you get that? Well, verse 14 is the passage. He lived among us. That word that's translated lived is the word that can also be translated tabernacled among us, which has certain connotations, of course. And then he talks about glory. What's glory? Anybody know what glory is? It's one of those words that we use quite a bit because the New Testament and Old Testament uses it quite a bit. But what does it mean? Anybody know? Yeah, not so easy, is it? It's, again, one of those terms that we use a lot, but when we really try to define it, it's difficult to come up with a definition. Okay, well, let's think about this. The literal definition of the Hebrew word that's translated glory means like weightiness. It's heavy, okay? So you go to pick something up, it's heavy. You could say it has weight. It's the same word. But, of course, that's not so helpful. Because this has nothing to do with literal weightiness. We've seen his weightiness, right? Is he big or something? That's not what it means. It has nothing to do with that, right? Metaphorically, he's weighty. He's heavy. Or we might just say great. But it also means something else. Ezekiel chapter 1. Is one area. Maybe it's not the easiest. Let me go to the easiest first, rather. Over the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, what was there? The glory of God. Okay, well, what does that tell us? That's some sort of manifestation of God that appeared over the mercy seat. Ezekiel 1 now. Ezekiel's in captivity. He sees this really bizarre vision. I mean, it's bizarre. It's flashing metal, you got faces of animals and humans. I mean, it's difficult. And so you read chapter 1 and you say, what on earth is he seeing? And in fact, just as an aside, in the 60s, a book was published that argued that what Ezekiel's actually seeing are UFOs, right? And of course, this still gets picked up in popular shows today. That's obviously not what he saw. It makes no sense in the context, even though it would be kind of cool, I guess. But that's my opinion. That's not what he's seeing. Well, what is it then? Okay? And the reason that interpretation can even be entertained, in this book that I mentioned in the 60s, sold a bunch of copies. And on that show, Ancient Aliens, on the History Channel, it's still popular. Well, how does it get to be so popular? Because you turn around and you read Ezekiel 1 and you say, what on earth is he talking about? No pun intended. What on earth? Get it. Everybody. No, what he's talking about, and it says it at the end. This is a chariot, but at the top of the chariot is the glory of God. It's God's appearance. It's God's manifestation. Okay, now here, which is it? And remember I said in the introductory lesson that John sometimes uses terms like this, uses ideas like this. It can mean one of two things, and he doesn't tell us which it is. So in other words, when you see Jesus, we see God's glory, which is stated, I think, more explicitly in other places. All right, the glory is of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Okay, now, truth, and we'll get into this later in the Gospel of John, but truth is an important concept in John. And it's not nearly as common in the Synoptics. So it's worth asking, what is truth in the Gospel of John? The way we use it, we typically think, all right, truth as opposed to falsehood. And so we make it, especially in a postmodernist society, we make it where you've got absolute truth versus subjective reality, maybe. Right? We make that distinction. Well, frankly, that's an Enlightenment distinction. Okay? And a lot of times in the Bible, when we see truth, I don't know that that's necessarily the case, that that distinction is how we should read it. Now, don't misunderstand me. That's not to say that people in the Greco-Roman world or people in the ancient world didn't understand the difference between truth and falsehood. They did. And the word has that connotation. Again, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But there's also another element here, and it has to do with faithfulness. All right? Full of grace and truth. Truth in the sense of faithfulness. So when God is said to be true, part of what it means, maybe not all of it, but part of it is he's faithful to his promises. And maybe that, I think that has something to do with what he's saying here. All right, verse 15, John testified. There's that word again, and we'll see it in just a minute in verse 19. But the testimony of John is important in this part of the gospel. This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks ahead of me because he was before me. From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. And now we get a discussion of the law. The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. All right, now verse 17. What's the opposite of grace? What?
Disgrace?
Well, in certain contexts it could be the case. What about in this one, though? When you talk about grace, when you talk about God's forgiveness and God's unmerited favor toward us, what would the opposite of that be? What? What? Sorry. No, not the opposite. The opposite of grace. Rejection, somebody say that? Did I hear that? Okay, well, I'll just pretend I heard it. Rejection and maybe judgment, wrath, unforgiveness. Well, are we going to say those things describe the law of Moses? Or the law of Moses, does the law of Moses have grace in it? Yes, it does. Does it have forgiveness in it? Yes. Does it have truth? Yes, it does. Okay, so that is not the distinction he's making. He's not saying, well, the law, you know, wasn't that great, but look at Jesus. That's not the comparison. The comparison is the law was given through Moses, and the assumption is it had grace and truth, but not in the way that you get it through Jesus Christ. You see, then the parallel becomes even more powerful. Because, again, if you say the law was just so weak and imperfect, then the comparison loses its strength. And I don't think he would say that. I don't think any of the New Testament writers would say, well, the law didn't have grace in it. And by the way, there are some people in the modern world who look at it that way. It's just not true. And that's not what he's saying here. So again, this reinforces the idea, Jesus represents the new Torah and in some sense embodies the new Torah. You get that in the Gospel of Matthew as well, right? Okay, verse 18. No one has ever seen God. We already have a problem here, right? What's the problem here? No one's ever seen God. Why is that a problematic statement?
You just said that Jesus is God.
Okay. Well, he's going to say that's the explanation to this phenomenon, but I think there's a bigger problem. Exactly. There are reports of people seeing God in the Old Testament. All right. So some people have a superficial reading would say, well, we got a contradiction here, a contradiction with other texts in the Bible. Let's just ask this question. Do you think John's unfamiliar with Moses seeing the glory of God? I mean, do you think he didn't know about that? He's never read that? That's ridiculous, frankly, right? To think that he's not familiar with those texts. No, he is. And so that makes the statement even more powerful and poignant, because what does he mean then? No one's ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, I'll explain that in a minute, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. So what does the beginning of verse 18 really mean? No one has ever seen God like this. That's what he's saying. Think about that. Think about those manifestations of God to Moses. Or what's the most impressive manifestation? Maybe it's at Mount Sinai, right? And by the way, these are referred to as theophanies. And I think that's important to introduce, because the Old Testament has quite a few theophanies where God makes some appearance, but that's not the same thing as seeing God, right? There's a distinction. Isaiah 6 is pretty impressive too. What does Isaiah say when he sees this manifestation of God? Anybody remember what he says? That's not what he's saying. That's what the angels are saying. What does he say? Woe is me. I'm undone. I live among a people of unclean lips, and I too have unclean lips. Which, by the way, why is he talking about his lips? Why does he just say, I live among people who are unclean and I'm unclean? He just says lips. I think it has to do with his prophetic calling. I think that's why he said it. But anyway, it's beside the point. The point is, he is so overwhelmed by God's glory, he realizes how insignificant he is. So as impressive as that is, this says, you see, Jesus, you really are seeing God like never before. And that's pretty incredible, because I think that could potentially change how we read these texts in the Gospels. Because the text, okay, do they tell us something about Jesus? Of course. Do they tell us something about Jesus as Messiah? Of course. As a prophet? Yes. But they also tell us something about God. And I'm not so sure we look at all those stories in such a way as to think, all right, what is this telling us about God's nature specifically? But I think that's a legitimate way to read it based upon this passage, okay? So, is anybody using the King James or New King James? Is anybody afraid to raise their hand? Because I really am skeptical that nobody's using the King James or New King James. You are. Do you mind reading after no one has ever seen God? Okay, thank you. The only begotten Son. This says it is God, the only Son. There's a textual variant here. Now, the only begotten Son is the reading that's attested in the, the New King James and King James versions. But those versions are based on a different group of Greek manuscripts. The more modern versions, New American Standard, New Revised Standard, the ESV, NIV, they've got something different. They have God, the only Son. Do you see how different that is? No one's ever seen God. It's God who's made him known. You see how problematic that is logically? That's why I think you've got that other reading attested. But there's a principle of textual criticism that says the harder reading, you might ought to go with it. I won't say you go with it every time, because that's not necessarily the case. But in this case, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say God the Only Son, I think, is the better reading, because it's the older reading and it's the more difficult reading. So here again, this matches what we have in the prologue. And that is, the Logos is God. But is he to be identified precisely with God? Like they're the same being? No, there's some sort of difference. So where can you go to see that Jesus is God, and even though they're not identical, they're part of the Godhead? This is it. The first 18 verses of John. Does this solve all the problems of the Trinity? No, not at all. It's not interested in that. But of course, 2,000 years later, has anybody got a good explanation satisfactory to everybody about the Trinity and how everything works? No, they don't. I'm sorry. In some of my classes, I don't do this anymore because I actually had a student take me up on this once. It didn't work out so well. But in my classes, I'll usually offer the challenge. And I'm being a little bit sarcastic. I know it's surprising. I'm being a little bit sarcastic because, and I'll say, okay, if you can write a paper sufficiently explaining the Trinity to me, you get an A in the class, you never have to come back anymore. All these years, not just at FC, I taught in Ohio and in Northern Kentucky before I got here. I would offer the same challenge. One student in all those years took me up on the challenge. Let's just say he didn't get an A, at least because of that, I don't remember. But he didn't get an A, and he had to come back to class. It was insufficient. It wasn't a very good attempt either, but anyway. That's just my point. No, it was okay. It was fine. But it demonstrates how difficult it is. Okay, so John introduces questions about that, but he's not interested in explaining how all this works. It's just not what he's doing. Okay. All right. So Jesus has made God known in a way that no one else and nothing else has been able or will be able to do. That's the point of verse 18. Okay, any questions or comments about the prologue? Okay, we're finished with the prologue then. All right, so things get a little bit easier. A little bit. But there are still some things here that I want to address because, all right, where I'm going now, my thought process is there are some things that are brought up here that are presupposed. And I want us to try to answer the question, why are these things presupposed? We so quickly read through them and we don't ask that question. Why are they asking him these questions? What does that suggest about what they've heard prior to this point? Okay, so this is the testimony. What's testimony, by the way? Okay, yeah, and some translations probably do that. I don't know for sure. This is the witness given by John, right? This is what he says, being in a position to give credible witness. We could say it that way, right? So the Jews send priests and Levites. Later on, we find out that it's the Pharisees who send the priests and Levites, which is a little bit bizarre. And in fact, some people said, John doesn't understand the politics, the religious politics of Jerusalem prior to AD 70. He doesn't understand it because the Pharisees couldn't have sent emissaries like the priests and Levites. The priests and Levites aren't going to listen to the Pharisees. Well, that's not entirely true. Josephus, in his autobiography, mentions Jewish leaders who are not priests, who are not Levites, sending priests and Levites. So there is precedent in a contemporary author for this practice. Okay, yeah, he doesn't specifically mention the Pharisees, but there's precedent for Jewish leaders. Okay, so I really don't think that's a problem. So they're coming to John and they ask, "Who are you?" What does that question presuppose? I'll let you try to answer this one. They're coming to John and they say, "Who are you?" What does that question presuppose? Yeah. Okay, there's differing views on who he is, which is exactly what we find next. All right, what else? What? Okay, I think that's another question. Where is your authority? How are you able to do these things? Why are you doing these things? What else? Anybody else? There's one more thing I'd like to point out. Yeah. Yeah, it could. And I think this question coming from the leaders presupposes he's getting some attention, right? I mean, think about it. If there's this dude baptizing people in the Jordan River, there are like two people who've been baptized. Are they going to go to the trouble to send these and say, hey, what are you doing baptizing these two people? No. It's a much bigger deal than that. And so, he says, I'm not the Messiah. Again, explicitly stating a difference between the Logos, Jesus, the Messiah, and John the Baptist. And then they say, what then? Are you Elijah? Why would they ask that? Anybody know? Yeah, very good. Exactly. The end of Malachi says that in the future, and I think it gets interpreted this way in the New Testament and later sources, that in the Messianic age, the forerunner to the Messiah is going to be Elijah. And by the way, in traditional Jewish families, even today, when they observe the Passover, there's a seat left empty for Elijah, because they expect him to return prior to the Messiah. Now, of course, I'm sure there are some Jews who believe he might actually show up. There are other Jews who do it because of a tradition, right? Differing beliefs about that. But anyway, that belief is still upheld by Jews today. All right, yeah. So they ask him, are you Elijah? He says, no. Is John ever connected to Elijah in the Synoptics? Anybody remember? Yeah, he is. Jesus refers to him as Elijah. But John says, I'm not Elijah. Now, how does that work? Well, it could be that John didn't understand the connection yet. That's possible. John the Baptist, I mean, not the author of the gospel. John the Baptist didn't understand the connection. Remember, does John the Baptist know everything? I mean, should we assume he knows everything about everything? No, there's no reason to assume that. So that's possible. But it's also possible that John, in wanting to distance himself from Jesus, he also doesn't want to have certain connotations that Elijah had, like performing miracles. Does John the Baptist perform any miracles that we know of? Nope, he doesn't. Does Jesus? Well, of course he does. And in fact, Luke explicitly connects the miracles of Jesus with those of Elijah, right? So that could be the answer. John wants to distance himself. So the answer then, if you were to ask the question, is John the Baptist to be identified with Elijah? You say yes and no. That's the appropriate answer. In some sense, he's definitely Elijah as the forerunner to the Messiah, the end of Malachi, like was pointed out. But then secondly, he's not Elijah in the sense he can perform these miracles that are indicative of the Messiah, right? I think that's the answer. And then he says, are you the prophet? And he answers, no. What is that, the prophet? What is that talking about? Anybody know? This is a little bit more difficult maybe, but anybody know? Deuteronomy 18, the passage talks about prophets and prophecy. And it talks about Moses as a prophet, and it says in the future there's going to be a prophet like Moses. That passage gets explicitly applied to Jesus in Acts 4. So that's an easier answer. That's why he says, I'm not the prophet. Because that, again, is reserved for Jesus. All these answers in the negative, therefore, are to show I'm not Jesus. But then they say, well, who are you then? Why are you doing these things? What authority do you have to do these things? So what do you say about yourself? And then he gives this famous quotation that you find in all the synoptics. I'm the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make straight the ways of the Lord, as the prophet Isaiah said. This is from Isaiah 40. And we could talk the rest of the time about this text, and I'm not going to, because there are a couple other things I want to get to today. But here, this is shows the preparatory nature of John. He's an intermediary figure to get the people ready for Jesus. That's, I think, one reason why he quotes this passage. Now, something else that's kind of interesting here, because of where John's baptizing, because of the way John's described, and because of this passage, some people have thought that John the Baptist might actually be part of the community who produced the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is an interesting possibility. But I don't think so because of his role here, but there are similarities. The Dead Sea Scrolls community actually quotes this same verse to talk about what they're doing. They're saying, we're the ones crying out in the wilderness. We're the true people of Israel. Whereas John says, no, this is me. This is my role here. So there are some interesting parallels. All right, anyway, that's just sort of an aside. So they say, why then are you baptizing if you're not the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? He says, I baptize with water. Among you stands one whom you do not know, and I'm not worthy to untie the thong of his sandal. What does that expression mean? I'm not worthy to untie a shoe, is the point. Anybody know what that might mean? Yeah, right. Why do you think? Why do you think it would be lower class individuals who would only do something like that? Well, probably because it's your feet, and feet are disgusting, especially if you're walking around and you don't have full protection like we do now, right? If you're wearing sandals, how dirty are your feet going to be? Very dirty, nasty, right? But of course, I don't know that this is intentional, but there's foreshadowing here, isn't there? Because at the very beginning of the second part of the Gospel of John, what is Jesus doing for his disciples? Washing their disgusting feet. That's incredible. John the Baptist says, I am not even worthy to untie a shoe. And then Jesus washes the feet of his disciples. It's incredible, right? Okay, now, here's what I really wanted to get to today. I wanted to make sure we got this far. What do these passages suggest about baptism? What is presupposed, then, about baptism in these passages? Anybody know? Yeah, okay, I think that's a good answer, right? Because they ask him, why are you baptizing? Notice they don't ask him, what are you doing when you plunge people into the water? They already know what it is. They already presumably know why he's doing it. And I think the belief is it's part of the Messianic age. But let me ask you this. All right, let's say you're the first, you hear this guy preaching. You're one of the first people to hear John the Baptist preaching. And he tells you, you need to repent, you need to get ready for the Messiah, but I need you to come here in this water, and I'm going to dunk you down in it. And the person's going to be like, you're going to do what? What does that have to do with anything? Right? There's no indication anywhere in any of the Gospels that that kind of conversation ever took place. Maybe it did, but there's no indication whatsoever. So therefore, then we need to ask, where does the notion of baptism come from anyway? Well, the obvious place to start is the Old Testament. any baptism in the Old Testament? Which is a bit of a trick question, I admit, but what do you think? Let me put it in a less tricky way. Anything like baptism in the Old Testament? Okay, what else? Right? There's cleansing rituals for that. What else? Okay, yeah, that is, and it's used in the New Testament that way, right? Metaphorically, yeah. Right, which is, and that is, again, demonstrates this process of cleansing. Okay, you've got priests preparing themselves for their work. So you have what is referred to maybe as ritual cleansing. What's the purpose of all those rituals? To cleanse somebody of something that is unclean. Does it have anything to do with sin? Not necessarily. So there's a clear difference. But did you have to be baptized to become Jewish? No. There's not one passage that suggests that. Okay, but when you get to the time of the New Testament, there are some passages and some other evidence which suggests this practice of becoming washed for ritual purposes at the very least were common. Okay, so here we have a couple of pictures of the Qumran Mikvaot. Okay, Qumran is the archaeological site of the Dead Sea Scrolls community, which were probably some Essenes, but we don't have to go into that. All right, so if you go to the archaeological site, which I can say I've been fortunate enough to go there to see these pools, because mikvaot is the plural of mikvah, which means immersion pool. Immersion pool, right? Look at these steps. What sort of washing is this? Is this like sprinkling or pouring on the head? No, this is immersion, which is it's worth considering, right? But you go down into the steps, you are immersed, and you come out. Okay, in the Dead Sea Scrolls text say you did this to become part of the community. Now that's a lot closer to what we're talking about with John the Baptist baptism, but even Christian baptism, right? Baptism you see in Acts, for example. That's much closer than anything we see in the Old Testament. But it's still not quite the same. Because there are other texts in the Dead Sea Scrolls that say, if you want to take part of the communal meal, you have to be washed before you go in. So this is not something that happens once to initiate you into the group. This happens every time you partake of the communal meal. This would be akin to us purifying ourselves before we partake of the Lord's Supper. We have to be baptized. It'd be like having a line here. Everybody has to be baptized before we can partake of the Lord's Supper. That's more like what this is. We don't do that. And why don't we do that? Because the New Testament doesn't command it, right? So there's a difference, even though there's some similarities. By the way, just as an aside, I don't know how well you can see this, but there's, particularly in the picture on the right, there's a dividing line here, and you see this in other examples of mikvaot, archaeological remains of mikvaot. There's a line here that divides people who are going down into the water from people who are coming up out of the water. And it's so that people who come down, they don't touch the people that are coming out. Because if they touch them, they render them unclean, they have to be immersed again. Right? That's the most likely explanation of that dividing line. All right, is class over at 9:45 or 9:40? Okay, good. Right, I thought I was going to have to end there. Not quite ready. All right, so we have a piece of evidence that baptism, at least for some people in the Jewish community, something akin to baptism was practiced by a community of people to initiate them into the community. There's evidence. There's also something that I think is a little bit closer, and I have to admit, I was kind of skeptical about this, but I don't know, some pretty good evidence here. Okay, this is from Epictetus. Epictetus is a philosopher writing in the first century AD, and you might say, well, what on earth could he tell us about baptism among Jews? Well, apparently something really important. Okay? So Epictetus, again, this is a roughly a contemporary of Paul. So his point here is, and by the way, this is a value. He says, why do you call yourself a Stoic when you don't know hardly anything about Stoicism? Right? Can we make any sort of application? Yeah. Can we be a Christian if we really don't know that much about Christianity? The answer is yes, you can, right? I mean, when someone first becomes a Christian, how can they be expected to know much? But how about after you've been a Christian for a long time and you still don't know very much about it, right? That's something we could all, I think, take to heart. Anyway, he says, why do you call yourself a Stoic? Why do you deceive the many? Why do you act the part of a Jew when you're a Greek? Do you not see how each is called a Jew, Syrian, or Egyptian? When we see a man inclining to two sides, we are accustomed to say this is not a Jew, but he acts like one. And when he has assumed the effects of one who's been imbued with Jewish doctrine and has adopted that sect, then he is in fact and is named a Jew. Thus we too, being falsely baptized, are in name Jews, but in fact we are something else. What he's saying is the Jews are known for baptizing people. Now, if this was the only passage we had in antiquity, we would say, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, he's not Jewish, so how could he really know? But there's other evidence. So we can't just dismiss him as somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about. And notice how he presents it. He presents it as if everybody knows how they are, right? He doesn't have to say, now the Jews practice baptism. He doesn't do that. He doesn't have to do that. It's presupposed, right? Let's look at some other evidence. This is in the Sibylline Oracles. What are the Sibylline Oracles? Good question. They're really strange. I'll put it that way. Some of them are composed by Jews. Some of them are composed by Christians. But most scholars think this is a Jewish oracle, the fourth one. He says, wash your whole body in perennial streams, stretch out your hands and ask forgiveness for former deeds and make propitiation for bitter impiety with words of praise. God will give repentance. He will not destroy. Again, this is a completely different source of information that calls upon people to wash their whole bodies. And by the way, in this passage, he's talking about Gentiles. And here's a final passage. This is from the Talmud. The Talmud is dated 400 to 600 A.D., so we already got a problem, don't we? It's centuries later. So anytime we use the rabbinic text, got to be careful with it. But given that we have other evidence, maybe what's being said here is true. Our rabbis taught, if a proselyte was circumcised but had not performed the prescribed ritual ablution, that's what we're talking about, ritual cleansing, Eleazar, who's a first century rabbi, by the way, he's a proper proselyte. So we find that our forefathers were circumcised and had not performed ritual ablution. In other words, the Old Testament never says that someone's not a Jew just because they haven't performed this ritual cleansing. Rabbi Joshua says if he's had the ablution but not the circumcision, he is a proper proselyte. So you see, they're debating about this issue. Now, if we can trust the text to report what first century rabbis actually said, here's the most clear evidence. Again, if this was the only evidence we had, I'd say, well, it's a possibility and nothing more. But I think it's stronger than that. All right, what does all this mean? Well, all this means, I think, is John the Baptist, and think about this, John the Baptist is calling upon people to be baptized. Ritual ablution, but connected to repentance, connected to entering in what at this stage we might say the messianic community. I think we could call it that. And so if proselyte baptism was a thing, which I think it was, he's calling upon Jews to be baptized too. You think they had a problem with that? Yep, I'm sure they did. They didn't like what John was saying. They didn't like what he was doing. But here's the difference. With regard to Christian baptism, you're baptized for the forgiveness of sins. It's a one-time thing. So yet again, and by the way, this shouldn't bother anybody, this shouldn't surprise us, because the ideas of Christianity didn't just fall from heaven, and they're completely unique, because people wouldn't understand it. It's kind of like the parable of the lost coin, right? Why isn't it the parable of the lost iPhone? Because they wouldn't have understood it. I mean, they wouldn't even understand how to conceptualize it. But that's the way it is with a lot of these things. So the final point is, when John is baptizing people, this isn't some unheard of practice where he would have to explain, okay, now, when I dunk you in water, this is... He didn't have to do that. Now, he might have to say, this is for not just Gentiles who wish to become proselytes. This is for everybody in the Messianic community. I think that's legitimate. All right? I hope that makes sense. If it doesn't, please let me know. All right? Thank you. We'll continue this on Wednesday.